Ready for the show? I'm ready to start.
10, 9, ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11. Tower clear.
Welcome to ET First Contact Radio. My name is Maarten Horst and I'm bringing you, together with my guests, the latest galactic news. We are here now on BBS Radio. The mainstream media is not important anymore because it's on BBS Radio. And my guest today is very special. Her name is Amy Vickers. And Amy Vickers is the CEO of the StarSat Project, a research organization dedicated to investigating a highly unusual human-like skull found in Mexico in the 1930s. The project has been coordinating research into this skull, known as the Starchild skull, since 1999, and now has convincing evidence, including preliminary DNA results, that the skull is a previously undiscovered species. Amy came on board in 2004, after hearing a lecture about the skull at the university in Australia, where she was studying archaeology and law, and continues to work as an unpaid volunteer. Introducing the Starchild Project. The Star Child project began in 1999 when author Lloyd Pye was asked to investigate an unusual skull by its owners, Ray and Malene Young. The skull became known as the Star Child skull, and between 1999 and 2013, Lloyd donated his time and resources to the project, enlisted the help of volunteers, and coordinated the numerous experts and independent medical and scientific institutions involved in research and testing. And the website for this is www.starchildproject.com. So, Amy, I want to really welcome you to the show. This is amazing.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, and we really do have some amazing things to talk about today.
Okay, why don't you start with the most important things that you want to share, the latest research findings?
Right, well, we'll dive right into it. For those of your viewers who aren't familiar with the Star Child skull, it is a non-fossilized bone skull, so just a normal bone skull. It's 900 years old, and it looks somewhat similar to a human skull, but is different in everything from the thickness of the bone to the size of the brain to the features of the skull itself, and even to the DNA. Now, in order to prove whether or not it's a new species, and in order to tap into the wealth of medical possibilities that could be hiding inside this skull, we need to recover the DNA, all of the DNA from this skull, what's called its entire genome. That's like your whole blueprint for your DNA. We need to recover the whole genome from this unusual skull. Now, we've been working on this for several years, and we've made some fantastic progress already. But basically, we've got to a point where we're stuck. Back at the very end of 2011, we were able to generate enough donations to get a sort of DNA testing kit, if you will, called slides. And these slides have generated just a ton of raw data from the Star Child's DNA, but it's a jumble. If you imagine thousands of encyclopedia sets that have just been shredded, so now they're all single letters and we somehow have to reassemble them back into what they were, that's the level of mess that we have, as you always do when you're dealing with unusual or ancient DNA like this. So we are now to the point where the lab can't do anything more, our genetics team can't do any more, we can't do anything more until we get an injection of funding, basically. And we need this to get some updated lab equipment, pay for a programmer to help us find this unusual DNA that we have, pay for specialized software. It's just a host of things that, unfortunately, you can't get for free. There's loads of people in the Star Child Project, myself included, who donate their time and their resources and everything that we can. But every once in a while, you come up against a wall where money is the only thing that will shift it. And unfortunately, we're at one of those walls. So we have a pretty large goal that we need to reach, which is about $75,000. But rather than just say, give us money because we need it, we have teamed up with Indiegogo, which is a crowdfunding website, to provide perks to people, basically rewards when you donate. So it's almost like a really awesome, fun way of shopping, where not only do you get something great that you wanted anyway, you actually are doing something really good at the same time in helping us fund our research. So if you go to starchildproject.com, you can have a look at the different perks that we have available. You can read some more information about the different medical and scientific endeavors that we hope will be furthered by the Star Child skull. And you can just have a look at our campaign. And even if you aren't able to put any money into it, which I understand there's a lot of people in that situation at the moment, don't feel like you can't do anything. You can always share us, send us around. Even if you and nobody that you know puts a single penny into it, just having people out there know what we're doing and know what we're trying to do, and maybe one day bumping into someone that can help us and telling them about it, that's really what we need at the moment. So go to starchildproject.com and have a look and get the word out.
Okay, wonderful. So do that, my friends. Share the word. Amy, I want to ask you a few questions. First of all, can you give us some reasons and some motivations for people to donate, and why the research is important? Because what kind of disclosures can it lead to when you're your analysis is true?
Well, this is always a question that everybody asks me, and if you ask me 100 times, I'll probably give you 100 different answers, because there are so many things that could come from this, and every single one of them is good. What we're talking about is a bone that has features radically different from ours. It's much thinner and lighter and much stronger than our bone. Now, wouldn't it be wonderful if in the DNA and in the structure of this bone, with research over time, we find something that can treat or cure or prevent osteoporosis, or something where there are these unusual fibers inside the skull, inside the bone of the skull, and we can't figure out exactly why they're there. There's nothing like that in any other bone on Earth. But our current theory is that they have something to do with strengthening the bone, or perhaps even helping it to heal. So maybe the next time you break your arm, there'll be a shot or a pill or something available that's going to radically decrease your healing time, or make the break heal much more strongly than it would otherwise. Pretty much everything that you look at in this skull could potentially one day, with research, lead to something wonderfully beneficial for humans, for us. Now, it's difficult because it's something where we can't promise any one thing, we can't guarantee any one thing is ever going to come out of this. But just about every aspect of the skull has something about it where you can see a benefit to humans. It seems to have possibly been able to grow multiple sets of teeth as it wears them down, like a shark does. I mean, that would be fantastic to eliminate the need for dentures and dental implants. I actually was a dental nurse while I was in university. That's how I was paying my way through. And the things that some poor people have to live with in their mouths, it would just be wonderful if there was some treatment you could have that would just make you grow new teeth almost like magic. Some of our genetics team has speculated that there may be some longevity or some life-extending treatments, that perhaps this being had a very long lifespan, over 100 or 150 or even 300 years. And so perhaps that's a little bit further down the line. That's a good bit more research and an awful lot more testing that would be required to get to that point. But as we always say, a lot of these things are long range, but if you never start doing something because the result is too far off, you're never going to get to the end of it. But if you start now, then eventually, a few years down the road, you will be to that point. So we're just so excited about the possibilities of this skull. And if that sounds a little bit far-fetched to anyone out there, all you have to do is go on the internet and have a look at the work that they're doing right now with the Neanderthal genome. Now, that was only recovered just a few years ago. We're actually using the same DNA technology, DNA recovery technology, that was invented and pioneered for use on the Neanderthal, on the star child, because it's the same situation. It's ancient bone, and it's a DNA structure that's just different from what anybody's seen before. So we're using the same technology that they're using. And what they are doing right now with the Neanderthal DNA is using it in medical research on just about everything you can think of. I was just reading an article that I posted to the Starchild Skull Facebook, which of course is Facebook/Starchild Project, about the research that they're doing to perhaps use the Neanderthal DNA to benefit research into AIDS and HIV and cancer, which of course are two really big issues of the day that medicine is just desperate to do something about, because there's so many poor people afflicted with it, including sadly Lloyd Pye, who is struggling with cancer at the moment. So if they can do that with the Neanderthal genome, which is a very similar case to the star child in that it's quite different from humans, but at the same time quite similar, imagine what we're going to be able to do with the star child skull. The possibilities are just about endless.
And what further implications could the star child skull bring after the research that you are requesting funding for will be released, the results?
Well, what we have at the moment is basically a mass of raw data. We don't know how much of the genetic code, how much of the genome is in that data. We just know we've got a lot of it. It probably won't be the whole thing. It's going to be a huge step forward for us. It may be enough to prove definitively this is not a human. But there will still be work left to do after that. But if it is enough to prove this is not human, that is going to open up a heck of a can of worms, because this skull is only 900 years old. Now, the last human-like thing on this planet that isn't humans supposedly died out at least 13,000 years ago. And if that's assuming that you take Homo florensis to be a new species, which I know that some anthropologists don't, but if you accept that the last human-like thing on the planet died out at least 13,000 years ago, this is only 900 years old. So that is just an enormous difference.
I understand. 900 years old, found in Mexico by this family. What happened in the years between 1930 and with the skull, the star size skull, and the time that got into Lord Pye's hands?
That is a very difficult question, because we aren't exactly sure either. Sadly, one of the things that's held back a lot of the research on the Starchild skull is that it was not found in a very scientific way. It was basically found by a teenage girl who was on holiday in Mexico. Her family was Mexican. She was first generation born in America. And she went back to Mexico, to the village where her parents were from on holiday. That culture is wonderfully rich and interesting, and they have a completely different relationship to skeletons than a lot of European cultures do. They're quite happy with them. They have no problem with skulls whatsoever. So she found a normal human skull and a very interesting one, and she thought, wow, these are fantastic. These will make great souvenirs. So without any permission, without any fanfare, she just stuck them in her luggage and brought them back to America. She coated them with shellac, which is basically a kind of varnish, and then she kept them in a cardboard box in her garage for most of her life. Had them out on display a few times, from what we understand, but basically just did nothing with them, just kept them her whole life, thinking there was nothing particularly special about it, and maybe thinking, oh, perhaps I shouldn't have taken these after all, because, you know, they might have belong to someone, they might be missing them. So she, when she passed on, left them to some friends of hers, who eventually gave them to Melanie Young. Now, Melanie, as you mentioned, is a neonatal nurse, or was a neonatal nurse at the time. She's retired now. And she immediately recognized that the unusual skull, the Starchild skull, did not look like any sort of deformity that she was familiar with. And working in a neonatal ward at the border of El Paso and Juarez in Texas, she had seen quite a range of different conditions. And this just looked so different from anything she'd ever seen before. She immediately recognized that something was special about it and that it deserved some more investigation. In fact, Melanie's first thought, and something that has continued with the Starchild project the whole way through, was the idea that this may be some sort of alien, a genuine extraterrestrial, not from this Earth alien. She thought perhaps of the grey species, you know, the little short ones with the big bulbous head and the big grey almond-shaped eyes. And so she wanted somebody that would be open to that idea, not necessarily someone that was just going to blindly ignore anything that didn't point to that, but someone that at least would be open-minded to it. And that was how she found Lloyd Pye. She asked around, and that was the name that kept coming up. So Melanie approached Lloyd and said, I have this unusual skull. I think it might be an alien. If it is an alien, are you prepared to help me put that out, or if it is an alien, are you just going to tell me to put it back under the bed? And Lloyd, of course, being very scientifically minded, said he thought it was probably just a human deformity, but whatever the answer was, whatever the science and the hard evidence said, he would be prepared to get up in front of anybody and say, this is what the science says. If it says it's an alien, I'll get up and I'll say it's an alien. So Melanie and Ray basically handed the skull over to Lloyd, along with the normal human skull that was found with it, that had been kept with it from the moment it was found, and gave him carte blanche to do as much research, to show it to as many experts and professionals as possible, and to see what could be discovered about it. And that was back in early 1999. Melanie and Ray got it in late 1998, so there was just a short lag. Lloyd got his hands on it and immediately went and had it x-rayed and CAT scanned and started showing it to experts. And any of them that were actually prepared to look at it, to hold it in their hands, to give it the time of day and actually look at it, couldn't explain what it was. The people who saw it from across the room or weren't prepared to take the time to actually learn anything about it dismissed it as this, that, or the other, hydrocephaly or progeria or cradle boarding or any one of a host of conditions that experts who have studied it have already ruled out. But everybody that actually looked at it and investigated it couldn't give explanations for it. And so now we have a really fantastic team of experts who are prepared to publicly say, I've never seen anything like this. And the most vocal of those, of course, is Dr. Ted Robinson, who we hope to be releasing some videos of very shortly. They're still in editing at the moment. But he is fantastic.
Yeah, I can't wait to see those videos. And then I have another question about the material of the skull, the composition. Are there any elements or rare elements, rare earthly elements like vanadium or molybdene or mangan or any of those rare elements are there in the skull?
Well, there's not particularly, but at the same time, we haven't done that much looking for them. We had in about 2003, possibly 2004, we were able to gain access to a scanning electron microscope that had mass spectrometry. Now, what that is, it's basically a special kind of microscope that can look at a sample of any sort, and by measuring, I think it's a laser or something they bounce off, but by measuring the way that those waves or what have you bounce back, it's able to tell you basically what the components are of whatever you're looking at. And I apologize for that not being a very scientific explanation, but basically it can tell you in general what's in the sample, but it's not fantastically specific, so it may have missed very, very low levels of things, and it also only looked at that one specific area of the sample, which also unfortunately at the time was contaminated somewhat with aluminium or aluminum, as they say in America, which we think was probably residue from the blade that was used to cut it. So it is possible that there are some really unusual or some really rare elements in there, but we've just been so limited in the funding that we have. We were only able to access that microscope because we're allowed to use it for free, basically. So now the technology has really improved and we would be able to get a much better result. It's just a matter of finding the funding to do that. And of course, if we are able to get this DNA result that shows that it's a previously undiscovered species, I'm sure all of those doors will open to us.
Yeah, that will be very interesting to know. And of course, you can analyze the compounds of a material with a laser. But there's also the classic method to do it in a laboratory with chemicals and see what elements are present in the skull.
There is, but unfortunately that destroys the sample. So because we started testing all the way back in 1999, back when everything needed huge samples of bone, we have taken quite a significant amount of the skull already for testing. So now we're trying to limit as much as possible what samples are taken and destroyed, just because once they're gone, they're gone. As far as we know, this is the only skull like this that has been found to date. So the more of it we end up destroying and testing, the more history will condemn us for it, we think.
Yeah. How is the condition of the skull right now?
It's currently held in a climate-controlled vault, but it has large sections of the bone at the base where the neck attaches and two large panels from the top of the skull removed for testing. Fortunately, these days the technology has improved so much that the amount that they need for DNA testing it is an absolute fraction of what they needed back in 1999. But back then we sacrificed teeth to it. We have a small section of the maxilla, that's the upper front jaw of the Starchild skull, that has mostly been used for testing. We still have a good chunk of it that still has teeth in it that we can access in the future. But because you can learn so much from teeth, we really hate to use them. But those are sort of our crown jewels that we're holding on to if all else fails.
Yes, I understand. Is there anything special about, have you been able to analyze the structure of the skull, of the bone, the structure?
We have that same microscope, that same scanning electron microscope, takes fantastically high resolution magnified images of the bone, and that's what we were using it for, really. We found two things inside the bone. We did two separate bone preparations. One we cut with a saw, which of course left sort of a jagged edge, and the other was done by snapping a small section of the bone off and then polishing it using lapidary tools, jeweler's tools, to let us see the structure of it more clearly. Now, the bone of the star child skull is between a third and half the thickness of normal human bone. It's much thinner than normal human bone, and it's almost like it's compressed. It has the same sort of structure of the two hard cortical layers and then the sort of sponge-like cancellous layer in the middle. But that's squished down, so it's tiny. You can barely see the holes with your naked eye. So we looked at that under a microscope, and inside those holes was a reddish residue that basically shouldn't be there. It's not bone marrow. After 900 years, any sort of organic material is going to be destroyed. If it was anything like blood or bone marrow, it would have turned black with age. But this is clearly red. It's absolutely inside the holes of the bone. And at the time we found it, there wasn't actually any sort of protocol invented, any way to take that residue out of the bone without contaminating it and find out what it is. They can do it now, of course, but that's another one for the wish list. But that wasn't even the most exciting thing that they found. When they looked at the section of the bone that had been cut with a saw underneath the scanning electron microscope, they found what we can only describe as fibers, little almost rope-like fibers coming out of the bone, going into the bone, all over it. Now, there has been some suggestion that this is perhaps fossilized collagen strands. There's vaguely similar looking things in other bone samples that are fossilized collagen, but the size is different, and nothing in the star child skull is fossilized. So basically, we don't know what these fibers are. They're just in there. The bone seems to be much harder than it should be. It's the same basic composition as human bone. It's not anything chemical about it that would make it as hard as it is to cut. I mean, I'm talking so hard that the bone saw bounced off it and they had to switch to a diamond-coated blade. It is really hard to cut. And we think that those fibers running through the bone have something to do with that hardness. And we think that those fibers could be one of the most interesting and exciting things from a biomedical standpoint once we can figure out what they are, how they got there, and whether we could put them in our bones to give them extra strength as well.
Yes. Did you test those fibers if they conduct electricity?
No, we have not been able to extract any of the fibers. It was the same situation. This just shouldn't be in bone. It shouldn't be in 900-year-old bone. It shouldn't be in fresh bone. It should not exist there. So there just wasn't a test invented to take it out for us to be able to do anything with it. The scanning electron microscope is so powerful, it actually destroys the sample as you're looking at it. It takes a photograph in the split second before the sample is destroyed by the heat that you're throwing at it from the light that you need to penetrate and look at something so tiny. Yeah. So we unfortunately haven't been able to recover it yet.
Yeah, if you could, with microsurgery, remove one of those fibers and see if it's conducting electricity, that would be interesting, I think.
It certainly would be. There's a number of tests that we'd love to do. One of them is to just shine a black light on it. There are a number of suggestions that they could be somehow related to Morgellons fibers. We don't think that they are. These are absolutely tiny compared to Morgellons fibers. You can't see them with the naked eye, whereas the Morgellons fibers apparently look quite thread-like and are visible with the naked eye. But if we can just shine a blue light on them, and if they don't fluoresce, which of course the Morgellons fibers do fluoresce, that'll put an end to that debate. But we'd love to know exactly what they are. We'd love to know exactly what they do. All of those sorts of tests would be absolutely fascinating. And we think that that's there are so many doors that really can't be opened until we have the DNA evidence, because until we have that, just about everything, no matter how amazing this sounds to a layperson, an expert whose job it is to be skeptical, who's paid to be skeptical and not want to believe anything, is just going to turn around and say, well, it's some sort of human deformity, it's some sort of contamination. We have had mycologists, we have had fungal and bacterial experts look at these fibers and say, there's nothing natural that does that. This is something that's part of the bone, it's indigenous to the sample. You've got something here, get it checked out. But those dedicated skeptics just won't listen to a word of it. And until we've got something that will get us past those, we really can't open all of those doors that we're looking for, all of those doors to funding and acceptance and access to all of these fantastic high-tech modern labs.
Yes. Amy, can you sum up the types of research that you want to do once the funding is there?
Oh, how long have you got? Well, the first thing, of course, is to get the entire genome. So our next step is 75,000. After that, we need to go after anything that's left. Now, the Neanderthal genome cost about $6.4 million to get a first draft, just to find all of the DNA one time. And they like to find it 10 or 15 times, ideally, to make sure they've got it right. But to find it one time took $6.4 million. So we're going to do it for quite a bit less than that. But still, that's the big wish list item. Once we have that done, we would love to find a way to test exactly the strength of the bone with minimal destruction to it, but find out exactly how much stronger it is than normal human bone, try and determine why it's so much stronger than normal human bone, have a look at that residue, see what that is. Is that some sort of organic organism that somehow is completely resistant to all of the bacteria we have here on Earth? And if it is, what does that mean? What are those fantastic fibers running through the bone? Are they something that's artificial? Are they something that's natural? Are they even some sort of contamination? If that's the case, then we'll accept the answer, but we need a real proper answer for it. We'd love to know anything that the DNA can tell us, which of course is another research project in its own right. What is it that makes the brain of this skull a third larger than ours? Or why does it need larger inner ears than we have? We'd love to get another state-of-the-art CAT scan done. We'd love to do a new scanning electron microscope test on it, because now they can do images in color. The only images that we have of those fibers are black and white. So we'd love to really get in there, do a whole bunch of mass spectrometry, and as you say, try and find out exactly what all of the bone is made up of. We'd love to run all of the new tests that are available on teeth. They can tell you just about everything from how old this being was when it died, which is up for debate at the moment. There are some features of it that say this is a child, and others that say this is an adult, and others that say this is a really old adult. So we'd love to just run the array of dental tests that can be done. And we'd love to have, just for the sake of interest, a few more artists' reconstructions done. We've had some absolutely fantastic artists work with us, and they've all come up with quite similar images, which makes us feel fairly confident that the look that they have is pretty well accurate. But it would be interesting just to, you know, have a few more of them done, have some more sculptures done, or have some more of the fantastic 3D art that can be done these days, and try maybe to reconstruct the rest of the skeleton based on the bones of the skull, and just access the host of wonderful things that you can get if you're a Svante Paabo or one of these wonderfully recognized scientists who does really mainstream work. It would just be fantastic for this really left of field, really not mainstream, really unusual, and we did everything the wrong way sample, to go up against those big boys and show them that you don't have to have a perfectly sterile archaeological dig to still do valid science.
Okay, well, that's quite a list.
Yes, I'm sorry, I went on a bit there, but I'm just so excited, I'm so passionate about this. Not just because it's interesting and I'm a nerd, a self-confessed nerd, and I love this stuff. I was studying archaeology in university because I just love it. But the good that can happen, maybe not in my lifetime, some of it. A lot of this research and development is going to go on for decades. but just the potential for it, to know that in some way I've helped that along, and maybe it's going to save someone's life one day, or maybe it's going to improve someone's quality of life. And just to leave a legacy like that is so exciting to me. I do get carried away with it.
It is, yes. Well, these are very exciting times, actually, Amy, because there's a lot of speculation about Comet Eisen and things like this. So it might be possible that disclosure could happen this season. You know, that would be wonderful.
It really would be. And that's an interesting point that you bring up, because as I mentioned, Melanie Young, who is the person who I guess you could call the owner of the skull, her first thought when she looked at it was, this looks alien. Now our definition of the word alien has shifted more to just mean something that's not human. But if this was to be really, really different from us in its DNA, if there is just no way that you can make a case for this being from Earth, I don't know how you can prove exactly that something is an alien, or that it's one type or another of alien, because the way that the scientific system is set up at the moment, you prove what something is by comparing it to something that we already accept and know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But at least it would open the doors to have a conversation about it. At least maybe it would get people to talk about this and take it seriously, instead of it just being the funny piece at the end of the news that everybody laughs about, someone wearing a tinfoil hat or the mayor of Arizona marching out someone in an alien costume.
Yeah, because we all know that the mainstream media is controlled, but hopefully this will end soon and honest and truth will be spoken. You know that the star skull is just an example, and it's a big example actually, but there are many more cases in the UFO research field that point to the fact that we are not alone. So I really hope that this time we can have a celebration all together.
Well, that would be great. It's as I say, it's a difficult thing to predict from a scientific standpoint, but I genuinely believe that there has been so much possible knowledge wasted by a scientific community that is dismissive of this, instead of being prepared to look at it in a more open and genuine way. And there are hoaxes, and there is a lot of nonsense out there, but you can't let that take away from the real science. There's people out there selling snake oils and magical cancer cures and things that are just a load of nonsense, but that doesn't stop them doing proper real cancer research. I think they need to treat everything the same way. Don't let the few bad eggs spoil the whole bunch.
Exactly. But a few more questions about the skull and the research. How long does it take to get the final research results from the DNA scan that you want to do?
Well, the one that we want to do, it's hard to give a definite answer on that, because until you start doing the work, you can't really tell how complicated it is. What we have at the moment is really just a jumble. You need specific software and you need a computer system with a specific amount of power in it to be able to handle the work that needs to be done. And then you basically need a full-time programmer there making constant tweaks and adjustments and changes to keep the whole thing running. So it's not going to be a quick answer. It's not going to be something where we can turn around in 2 weeks' time and say, hey, here's the result. It's right. Going to be something that's going to take over several months and possibly as much as a year. But the budget that we have will give us what we need. And if we raise more than that, I mean, that would be absolutely fantastic. The more we raise, the more work we can do and the faster we can get it done.
Yes. And imagine that you have the equipment, the money for the equipment. You buy the equipment. Do you have a laboratory and people with a degree who can work on it to actually do the test?
Oh, absolutely. Now, when we say we have a laboratory, all of the work that we do is contracted to independent labs. I'm a volunteer, and all the other people in the Star Child Project are volunteers, but all of the work that gets done is contracted out to independent labs. They're our head of genetics, if we can call him that, has two PhDs. He is an expert. He has a dedicated ancient DNA lab. I mean, he's an absolute top shelf scientist, which is why I'm not able to tell you his name, unfortunately, because this is a controversial or an interesting subject, and it's the sort of thing where if the general public found out what lab we were using and what scientist we were using, we'd have the same situation as they had in England with the Natural History Museum when Zachariah Sitchin wrote in his book, oh, they've got this thing at the Natural History Museum that I think needs to be DNA tested. Well, the poor museum was absolutely inundated with phone calls, with letters, some of them demanding, some pleading, some begging, some threatening. And they basically had to put on a new member of staff just to deal with this massive influx. It didn't help them in any way. They don't have DNA testing facilities there. They didn't have the funding to do anything anyway. They basically told everybody, as soon as we have a reputable lab that's got the funding that wants to come and do it, we're very happy for them to come and test it. Please, somebody come and test it. But there was nothing that they could do, and it was just a huge hassle. So basically, the lab that we're working with and the geneticists that we're working with, we unfortunately can't tell you exactly who they are because they just don't have the resources to deal with the public attention, and they don't want to deal with the hassle and the security issues that would come with it. But it is in the States. It is an absolute top level independent lab. They work with a lot of the major companies. They do projects with the universities in the area. In fact, one of those universities let us borrow one of their supercomputers to try and work through some of this data, and we overloaded the system, unfortunately, and the administrator kicked us out. But I mean, it's really, this is a top shelf organization, and we're so grateful to work with them. And more than that, we have a genetics team that is open minded and is just interested to find out what this sample is and isn't dedicated to getting any one result or another.
Well, that sounds fascinating, that the computer system overloaded.
Well, I'm not an expert on this, and I'm sure that somebody that is could give a much more accurate definition. But as far as I'm concerned, the system got overloaded and the administrator got quite unhappy with us and said, you know what, we need to free up these resources for other people. You're just making a mess in there and you're not getting the data that you want anyway. Go and find the actual kind of system that you need and the actual software that you need. And so that basically is where we are at the moment. It is a very specialized area of science that does require very specific equipment, very specific software, very specific expertise. And that sadly is why we've come up against this wall, and we're to the point now where it's basically funding or nothing. We just have to do it.
Yeah, just a thought here. Those computers, they can analyze billions of molecule sequences, DNA sequences per second. So imagine if the DNA from the star skull will be completely different than any species known on Earth. I can understand why it would be difficult for those computers to analyze the DNA sequence.
Absolutely. And this is something that confuses people, because these days you can get your own DNA tested for a couple of $100. But that's modern DNA. There's no degradation. There's no contamination. And it's human DNA. We know exactly what human DNA looks like. For as different as people are, there's actually very little difference between us in our DNA. There's more variation. You've probably heard this before. There's more variation in one family of chimpanzees in their genes than there is in the entire population of humans on Earth. Our DNA is basically pretty similar to everybody else's DNA. So if that's what you're looking for, it's really easy to find these days. But when you're looking for something that's so different, that's mixed up with contamination that's inevitable when you're dealing with a 900-year-old sample. I mean, think of all of the bacteria that's crawled over it and died and left its DNA, and all the people that have touched it and left their DNA. There's a lot of contamination to strip back. There's a lot of steps that need to be taken. And there's an incredible amount of expertise required to not only find something that you don't even know what it looks like, but then to put it back together into the correct sequence and the correct order, again, not knowing what it's supposed to look like. So, I mean, that's the real genius of it, and that's why it was so difficult for them to recover the Neanderthal DNA, and they had to invent an entire new system, which is the same thing that we're using, that instead of looking for something that looks like human DNA or something that looks like chimpanzee or monkey or dog or whatever you're looking for DNA, it just looks for the DNA and then afterwards combs through and finds just the one sample, just the one thing that you're looking for. It's really amazing technology.
Yes, it is. What would be the most shocking discovery about the skull for the scientific community?
Well, and I need to preface this by making clear that this is a preliminary result. Whenever you get a DNA result, you want to repeat it over and over and over again to make sure that you don't have some bizarre kind of contamination or error or something going on. So we haven't done that. This is a preliminary result. We followed all the protocols. We did it right. And we have a result that we consider to be valid, but we're not going to be happy with it until we've done the test 10 times and we've got the same result every time. That said, we have recovered a segment of what's called the FOXP2 gene. Now, this is a super gene. All humans have it, and crucially, it is identical in all humans. Your FOXP2 looks exactly like my FOXP2, looks exactly like everybody else's FOXP2. Now, if you have some sort of mutation or problem, yours is obviously going to have one or two little differences in it. But the reason this is called a super gene is because it's super important. It is crucial to a number of the systems in your body, from your brain to your respiratory system to your motor skills. Everything just about is tied into your FOXP2 gene. So if there's anything wrong with it, any one thing wrong with it, there's going to be something wrong with you. And the most famous example of this and why it's called the speech gene is that there was a family who were all completely mute. They couldn't make a sound, but they had one mutation, one little bitty thing different about all of their FOXP2 genes, and that prevented them from being able to speak. So basically identical gene, unless you've got some sort of problem, and then you're going to have one, maybe two things wrong with it. The segment of the FOXP2 gene that we found in the Starchild skull, not even the whole gene, just a segment, has 56 differences.
Wow.
Now, a human cannot survive having that many differences. One, you can survive, maybe. Two, you can survive, maybe. I don't think there's anybody on the record that's ever survived three or more differences in their FOXP2 gene from what it's supposed to be. And we already have 56 in the Starchild skull's genome. And you can go to the starchildproject.com website, and we've got a great little graph there that shows you things. I think a tree frog has 26 differences from human. The Starchild, 56 differences. I mean, this is fantastic news. Now, again, we need to verify it and make sure. But, I mean, this just leaves me speechless. It leaves my jaw dropped. This cannot be human with a FOXP2 gene that looks like that. It just can't be.
And are there gene sets that are abnormal from human DNA, from human genes?
Well, it's a little bit complicated. There is DNA, and then there's actual genes that are made up out of DNA. So we haven't found very many actual parts of genes. We have the FOXP2 segment, which is part of the FOXP2 gene. But most of what we found are just sort of loose segments that we haven't been able to attach to any particular gene. But even a loose segment can tell you an awful lot. Mm-hmm. What they do these days is you take your little sample that you've recovered, your little segment of DNA that's a few hundred base pairs or a few thousand base pairs long. Now, just to make it clear to your listeners, if you think of the shape of DNA, it's like a twisted ladder called a double helix, twisted ladder thing. Each step in that ladder is a base pair. There's over 3 billion of them in each person, in each person's genome. So if you think of just a few hundred or a few thousand of those little ladder steps joined together, you can take that and you can compare it to all of the DNA basically that we have on record at various different libraries of DNA, if you will, that are scattered around the world. And the big one there in America is the NIH database, which is called the BLAST system. You can Google that quite easily. So what you can do is you can send your DNA result off to the BLAST system, and it will basically just run it through the computer and let you know if there's anything that's ever been seen before that's even remotely like what you have in your sample. Now, we did that with all these little snippets of Starchild skull DNA, and we had a couple of them that came back and said, yes, this is a match to a human on chromosome 1, on chromosome whatever. So, yes, this part's a match to human. We had other sections from the same sample that came back, no similarity found to anything in the database. And I should mention we had one that I think was similar to a zebrafish. And just basically there's nothing close to a human anywhere in these samples. Now, how does that...
That's very interesting. Go on.
Well, the question then is, how does that happen? Does that mean that you've found little bits of human DNA and the rest of it is somehow contamination? Well, no, actually, it's really common to find little segments of DNA in a sample that are a match to something, even though that sample is completely different. And one of the great examples, since it's Thanksgiving for a lot of people in the States, is that a few years ago, they were able to recover DNA from a Triceratops fossil that was found in America. And it was a university there in the States that was doing it. And they did the same thing. They ran it through the database to see if it was a match to anything. And their segment of Triceratops DNA came back a perfect 100% match to a turkey. Wow. A gobble-gobble Thanksgiving dinner turkey. Now, that doesn't mean the Triceratops was a turkey. It just means it had a section of its DNA that was a perfect match, which is the exact thing that we've had happen in the Star Child. Now, there's probably some similarities, maybe something to do with the bone between the Triceratops and the turkey. There's definitely similarities between the Star Child skull and a human, but finding a little bit of human DNA just doesn't make the sample human. You can ask any geneticist out there. At a basic high school level, you think, oh, yes, if I found a little bit of human DNA, that makes it human. Well, it's just so much more complicated than that. And our genetics team is quite clear that it's very interesting. It's good that we found a little bit that's matched to a human. It's going to make it a lot easier to sort through that jumble of data that we have. But no, basically, it doesn't make it a human. We all still have to keep working and trying to figure out what this is, which is exciting, again, if you're a nerd like me. But yeah, it's also a lot of hard work.
Yes. Amy, then I have another question. We know that in human DNA, there's also, they call it junk DNA, and I think it's a large proportion. Now, if you start to analyze this junk DNA, you're going to find some interesting finds, especially in young children, and some researchers confirm that there are now already children with 4 or 5 or 6 strands of DNA, and they call that junk DNA. But what about the junk DNA in the Starchild skull?
Well, junk DNA is one of those terms that science is already coming to regret ever having used. Basically, when they say it's junk DNA, they would rather say that than we don't know yet DNA. It's all no, don't ask me about it DNA. Basically, we talked about there being genes and then there being just sort of loose bits of DNA. Well, when they talk about your junk DNA, they're talking about all of the loose bits. Now, it doesn't mean that so-called junk doesn't do anything. It just means they don't really know exactly what it does at the moment. But it obviously has some sort of purpose, or it just wouldn't be there. I mean, that doesn't make sense if you carry through the idea of evolution and this, that, and the other. Basically, they're finding all the time that junk DNA does things that we didn't know that it did, that we didn't understand that it did. And that's another one that's fun to Google anytime you're lonely on a Saturday night. But yeah. But basically, a lot of what we're looking at in the Star Child is in the so-called junk. But even that junk is very, very similar across humans. And so finding something in there that's so radically different is incredibly exciting.
Mm-hmm. And also, even if it's junk DNA, we now start to unravel the functions of it. It is still genetic material. And the integrated part of all the genetic material in the Starchild skull should be analyzed, and that would be really interesting.
Absolutely. And I mean, we don't really have a choice anyway. The way that this new technology works, you can't really pick and choose which parts of the DNA you're looking for. It just pulls everything out. It's like a giant net going along and just catching up all of the DNA, and then you have to sort it out afterwards. So we need to recover all of it anyway to find those specific genes. But again, there's so much that we continue to learn about the so-called junk DNA. I think that at the end of the day, a couple of generations from now, people are just going to laugh off their chairs trying to imagine people considering what I'm sure is very important to be junk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and but I think that when proper research would have been done in the future with all the equipment, then this could be the story of the century, actually.
We certainly think so. I mean, again, there is not supposed to be anything but humans walking around on two legs on this planet 900 years ago. And yet we have this being buried in the same mine tunnel as a human, clearly having some sort of cohabitation, some sort of living together and interaction with modern humans. This just turns everything we think we know about evolution, about the human family tree, all of it on its head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is very particular, peculiar.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, again, it's one of those things that's just complicated enough to make a lot of people turn off to it and not get excited about it. But it's really basic when it comes down to it. This thing is unusual. It has unusual DNA, and it was alive when it shouldn't be. We can use that unusual DNA to maybe prove that it's a new species, to do all sorts of wonderful things for medicine, to help ourselves. And it's going to be really, really interesting. What's not to like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I'm quite actually very fascinated by the whole research about the Starshot skull. We did an interview last year, I think in August or when was it?
August, I think you're right.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a nice interview. But can you sum up the developments that or the discoveries that you have found since between then and now?
Well, to tell you the truth of it, a lot of what we've been doing between then and now is exhausting all of the options, trying to find ways that basically wouldn't cost us anything to find out what is in this DNA data that we have. We've really just tried everything that we can, and now we're to the point of needing to raise the funds to go forward. And so we've developed this campaign that gives people rewards for helping us out, and so you get that great feeling of doing something good and being involved in something interesting, and you get a really cool T-shirt or a skull replica or all of these fantastic things that you can get at different levels of donation at the same time. So we're really wanting to move the research forward and have really tried just about everything that we can do at this stage. We have had a few more artists look at it. We've gotten some more work done with Dr. Ted Robinson, just going over and verifying, no, it's absolutely definitely not progeria. And there's some great new stuff on the Starshot Project website that just makes it clearer to people the reasons why it's not any of these commonly stated deformities. But very, very sadly, we've not been able to make any progress at all on the DNA testing, which is what we really would love to be doing.
Yes. Well, Amy, I'm very grateful that you were on the show with this very interesting story. And let's hope you get a funding as soon as possible. So go to the starchildproject.com and spread the word on your Facebook, Twitter account, anything. It's a very, very interesting. It could develop to be one of the most thrilling stories of the century.
We certainly believe so, and thank you so much for having me.
You're always a star, Amy.
Well, it's a real pleasure, and it's always so wonderful to speak to someone as genuinely interested as you. Thank you again.
Yes, thank you so much, Amy. And Sunday I will be on Finding Voices Radio, and Monday also on Finding Voices Radio with Evers Contact. And next week again here on BBS Radio. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.